This is a Pinball News production.
Okay, so we're kind of sort of going on the fly here. We have a nice little presentation, but didn't realize that we didn't have a screen to go on. So it looks really great up here. What we're going to try and do, too, is like when we were out at California Extreme last year, we kind of did more of a crowd-around style thing anyways, because when you start talking hardware from a long distance, if you're not seeing where it plugs in and where it goes, it's just a nice talk, I guess. So let's see. Oops. Okay. So you want to go on there?
Yes, sir.
So why Fast Pinball? Well, it's like we wanted to build a developable platform to build on, get the designer on top of the playfield faster, bring new technology to pinball and carry on the strong pinball tradition, develop a hardware interface that appeals to developers of all kinds. So,
yes, I think one of the things that was most exciting, when we kind of got into this, was like the idea of building a platform that let people, like Dave said, get on top of the playfield faster. Like, what attracts people to making games and working on pinball games is not usually how it's wired up and how everything connects and stuff. It's that vision, that idea of something you want to make, whether it's resurrecting like an old game or like actually creating something yourself. And so, when we set to build a platform, it was something that we felt, could take care of running any game that exists so far, that's out there, and be a good solid base for bringing in new technologies and stuff like that that we thought would be great at pinball, but doing it in a way that like kept the pinball traditions like strong, not try and turn pinball into something else, but like actually like make a foundation that can grow from the hobbyist making a custom thing. And if that catches on and people love it and they want to go further, do a boutique run of games or do a commercial run, we want to make sure the hardware went the whole distance. Let's see. Okay, next here. So one of the things that was fun when we brought this out, we thought that like when we first showed off the idea of making hardware, it was at the Northwest Pinball Show like a couple years ago. And, we didn't tell a lot of our friends what we were working on and stuff because, it was just kind of a pet project. But when we brought it out, the response was really exciting. Like, the people that engaged, right away were, it was a weird mix of, artists and, game designers, but not pinball game designers. People who had, the idea of playing pinball, and they might make mobile OS games or things like that. But the idea of, an API hardware interface for physical hardware, there really wasn't a slick solution for that. And so the game designers were excited about taking their game experience and game knowledge and building a pinball game. And the artists who, love the culture, love the art of pinball and stuff, love the idea of being able to apply that to a game, but maybe the idea of hooking up a pinball game was too daunting. So we really wanted to say, let's create a platform that can be enticing to people who are not already in pinball and see what kind of new ideas and stuff like that come in. But it was also cool that when we started talking about making new hardware, we had a lot of really excited, cool people who have worked with existing hardware, who have written a lot of code, who spoke up right away going, hey, if you're going to make hardware, I've got a couple things you should consider, some problems I've seen in other solutions, or some challenges that they think they have a novel approach on. And so I was really excited to see those people, jump right in. Brian and Gabe over here were like, we're making a new universal platform, or even universal framework. What a great way to kind of sync up. So even for us not having to, build a new framework and try to introduce a whole new framework on the community, the unified framework is really slick because, I'm sure Brian and Gabe went into in their presentation, being able to let the hardware guys compete for hardware and the best solution there, but for people invest the time and energy to develop a game and develop games in general, having to learn multiple frameworks and dividing groups into the developer groups into camps is really not the way to develop a good, strong pinball framework. Then I'd say the builders and stuff too. We wanted to make sure that the hardware itself scaled well. It wasn't a matter of you had to put an enormous cash outlay to get all these options, and then if you didn't pick the right configuration, you're kind of stuck. With the network design, it can kind of grow as your design goes. So one of the ideas that we had was be able to start up with a basic kit to get your lower third going. You got your flippers flipping, your ball drops working, everything else. And so you can start working on shot lines and see kind of as your game develops. So really try to pay attention to all the different people and their different paths, I guess, to getting into building and designing.
It may as well, since we don't have visuals, let's pass the board around. And so this was one of the first boards we made. This is for going into a WPC or WPC-ESH machine. All the traditional connectors are there for power. This goes out to the driver board, so we didn't have to recreate all the drivers. This is the switch matrix down here. So pretty much this will run your machine as it is. All the rest of the hardware in it right now. Let you tinker and also we can put a BeagleBone Black on here, or you can drive it from a PC through USB. So really the experience is pull your old board out, put this board in there, and you can start to develop your change your game or start to develop right. something new with it.
And that, this is and for, again, for like the WPC, WPCS era game. You know, part of like, you know, what we tried to do with the hardware and the technology that supports it was not just make it about like, here's this one form factor, you know, wedge it in where you need to, or create all different variations that might fit different uses. We want to make sure the technology actually in the board itself was modular. So this form factor was, you know, providing the interfaces needed to drop right into an existing game. And, you know, we'll show some examples of our core controller, the new controller that we have, that actually also has another interface out to sync up or interface with System 11 games or Classic Valleys and things like that. But it was really cool to take the technology and make it totally modular, even down to like what's on the boards. So we were talking real quick about some of our upcoming like milestones we've got. You know, whenever you start building a project like this kind of in the public eye, everyone's going, I want it now, I want it now. And one of the things we wanted to do was make sure that we developed in a way that kind of future-proofed it so that we could develop a low-level protocol in the hardware itself that if we change the processors that we use or the interfaces that drive it or new chips come out that we'd be better to use, that way that you communicate with it doesn't change. So, for example, like the Mission Pinball Framework, for example, they talk to our hardware at that low-level protocol interface. So, when you're using the Mission Pinball Framework, it's kind of all been taken care of. But if you were using our hardware directly and you wanted to write games using like Unity or I've done examples in JavaScript before, that protocol was designed to be really easy to work with. So our upcoming milestones is obviously like the full hardware availability. As we're rolling up to the end of the year here, we're seeing all of our controller boards, the network boards that control the drivers and input switches. Our LEDs, we actually put the LEDs up already to test out our online store.
You'll pass and, those out. We finally have something in mass production there.
So. And then we also have a couple other things that we're going to be working on with like a dedicated like on the board that's going around. There's actually an onboard RGB LED controller, which obviously didn't exist in the original boards. Using the new RGB LED lights or LEDs that are out there, it takes a specific communication protocol and done in a certain way so it's reliable and stable. And we had the opportunity with the space that we gained even on this board to wedge that on top of it. But we had a lot of requests for people who had existing projects going, say, could I just use just that part of it in my existing game? So we were able to, again, like take that modular piece even on the board itself and turn that into a standalone piece that you can integrate with it, any other project that you have going. So that's another piece that we've got coming forward. And then one of the things that like I think is really exciting, and this board here real quick, this is our, we call it a 3208 board, and this is 32 direct input switches and 8 drivers. And what it also has on there is like a daughter board interface. So you hear me refer to the daughter board here and there. The idea there is that we want to create an open interface that third parties can design and create toys for, not having to know anything about how your game's wired up itself. So like if they know that you're using the fast hardware and you say, I want a Rudy head, but I want it 3D printed to look like my boss, so you can be yelling at me as I'm playing the game, like whatever theme you come up with. It's hard for a third-party group to design a drop-in piece to your hardware because it becomes what drivers do I have available, what voltage are you using, blah, blah, blah. But if we can have a standard interface that they can dev and test against, it creates an opportunity for third parties to then create toys and modules and stuff like that to add to your pinball game. And it really kind of feeds that need for creativity and new feature integration and stuff like that. So we want to make sure that the foundation that we set up in the hardware was not just a useful piece for running existing games, existing formats, but a gateway to get new people creating new pieces and parts and actually get them into the games. Anyone want to talk about a couple of examples of them?
Yeah, so for some of the first daughter boards that we want to create, one of them is a lot of people want to play with servos because it's, they're fairly inexpensive. You can do a lot of things with them, move ball, lock balls, So we're going to make a servo controller daughter board that goes on there, and I don't know how many channels it will be, but we'll probably have at least 4 channels of servo on there.
And this allows you to like raise and lower targets, and like create different other robotic animation or animated characters and stuff like that.
And then also another one that we've been requested is some type of like open drain driver board, so to control relays, to control bigger loads or what have you. But the way the framework sees these daughter boards is there's just a method to exchange data to and from the framework. So when you put a daughter board on there, you're basically telling it, the system, how much data input output that you want to control, and then the framework will use those bytes to sit there and control whatever hardware you come up with. So that's kind of the way it works at the highest level to control these daughter boards.
And again, too, it makes like the idea of all these different ways you can create toys and stuff like that and get them into your game into a standard, consistent way to do it. Because if you're working with a software framework or whatnot, if it becomes a a totally custom, unique thing every time you integrate a new feature. You know, some people, especially when they're creating their first game, might be less inclined to do so. But we really wanted to make the barrier of creating new novel things like really low. You know, to appeal to people that are, you know, maker community like folks that are using Arduinos to build cool toys and stuff like that. It's really designed to cater to the people that are doing things like that, you know. You know, our next topic was, what opportunities does this, you know, provide us? You know, obviously, like, creating new games is really exciting. And we had the opportunity this week to spend some time with our friends, Skippy Pinball, and they let us take our hardware and shove it into a new game that they're working on and try it out and see what it looks like when it's in a full-fledged game, in progress. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun working with different groups doing different designs and new games and things, because our goal is to make the hardware part, like, a non-issue, like, get the baseline up and get it running, and then get back to focusing on your game design and stuff. So we've made a lot of friends who are working on a lot of really cool projects, and you know, obviously we're antsy to see that stuff come to light. So, you know, over the next year, year and a half, 2 years, and on, I look forward to seeing some of these projects that are kind of building the wings come to light. So, and you know, some from names that you know, and others like, you know, that you've never heard of before, coming at it from a totally different angle and totally different industries and experiences and stuff. And that's, you know, as someone who's really turned on by creating something out of nothing and building things, seeing new, fresh ideas come in and seeing what our hardware enables them to do is going to be a lot of fun. The next being the enhanced games. Last was it March, April, at the Texas Pinball Festival, Rick was talking about the idea of Rick from Planetary Pinball was talking about the idea of the WPC 2.0 games. And, you know, there's a lot of interest. I mean, you've seen what's been done with, like, the Brighta Pinball 2.0 and stuff that Dutch Pinball did. There's a lot of interest in people going in and modifying and tweaking their existing games. And, you know, it's an idea that has been talked about all over the place. And since that announcement, you know, a lot of people have come to us and said, like, you know, we want to make sure that we have the control to, you know, go in and take an existing game and not have to rewrite it from the start. It would be great if you had a modern code base of the game so that we can go in and tweak and modify it. You know, change callouts, change some scorings, like modify modes, because modifying something that exists is a little easier and less intimidating than rewriting a whole game from scratch. So, like, with the enhanced games, I think that also, too, the idea that different new games can exist. And so we've worked really hard to start to develop a platform and delivery mechanism and things that lets the existing IP holders and content holders protect their assets the way they need them to protect their assets in a way that that gives the IP holders the peace of mind and the comfort that they need, knowing that if they put these new opportunities out there, they're not just, you know, throwing everything they've done and protected out of the wild. So it's one of those things that everybody wants it to be a super easy process, but there's, you know, some old school, like, restrictions and stuff that are in place, and we worked hard to, you know, develop a platform and stuff like that that works to deliver that. So that's one of those topics that, you know, you'll continue to hear more and more about over the years to come, or the days, months, years to come. And then the future opportunities, I mean, that's kind of just a question. There's a question mark at the end of it on our slide up here. You know, I think it's going to be a lot of fun to see what people can start doing with this hardware, you know. You know, when you're not so concerned about how it all hooks up, you can create some new things. I mean, this pinball machine looks all busted up here on the table. It's something that we made as, like, a booth demo for the show last year. And it's a fold-up machine that actually checks with my luggage and flies on the plane. And so it made its first debut here last year, and then it's been to the Texas Pinball Festival and California Extreme and all over the place. But it's just kind of fun when you can take, like, you know, this was an old Aztec EM that was destroyed and sanded it all down and put new modern hardware on it and was able to, you know, bring it back to life, add RGBLD controllers and stuff. So I look forward to start seeing at these shows what people start making and dreaming up with the hardware we make. Do you want to do that one?
Let's see.
Maybe drink water.
Okay. Let's see. New game creation. Simple, solid platform intended to support customs to commercial. So, you know, what we try to do is, like, there's all kinds of, you know, things you have to care about when you sit there and try to release a game. Like, cutting a high voltage when you open up the coin door. It's like EMI. It's, you know, just all the things you have to do to make sure that you've done right before it gets out there. Because, you know, if you sit there and release the game and all of a sudden find those type problems, it's like recalling these things to refix those problems up is really difficult. So we're taking a lot of care to try to make sure you get it done the first time right. So we're in our documentation and on our boards, like, for instance, on our boards, that driver board that was passed around, is like, it has a overcurrent detect in there. So if any of the MOSFETs in that board get overstressed, it's like we can shut them down before it even blows the fuse. all of the inputs, the switch inputs on there, are protected up to 80 volts. So if somehow you get to one of your drivers connected onto one of your switches, it's like you're not going to blow that out.
Yeah.
We've done it multiple times, and so far nothing's happened, so it's good. So we're just trying to take care of a lot of things like that so you don't have to worry about those things. You have to be educated on it. We're going to try to help share that. But at the same time, we're doing our part to try to make sure the hardware is solid enough that you don't have to care about those things.
Yeah, and I think that, like, you know, that's the thing with, like, pinball. You know, I talk about all the time how it's a really great chance to get in and learn a lot of new cool stuff. You know, for a lot of people, it's their first dabble in serious electronics or building or designing or anything like that. So part of what we wanted to do with our hardware was work in best practice designs and concepts from the beginning. You know, you need to have fuse protection, things like that. So we made a cool fuse block that actually, like, I think we'll have a picture of it later on that we can show you up here, at the booth. But it actually, like, from a distance, the fuses light up green from behind when they're good, and when they go bad, they turn red. And it's just a novel little way to be like, hey, that fuse is blown. But by building these concepts and stuff like that in from the beginning, the last thing we want to do is tell people, like, here's most of the stuff that you need to get things going, and go learn a little bit about electronics, learn how to protect the stuff that you've done. And I think that, you know, because it's such a good opportunity to start in and get learning things, you know, being able to work those things in the beginning is the responsible thing to do. And again, like, we can't protect and do everything, but, you know, we look at it as, like, if you start from your custom game and it grows and grows and gets more popular, and you want to go and do a commercial release, to have you have to start the whole thing over again way late in the game would be, like, you know, kind of a waste of time. And I think that, you know, we can design and set up the hardware as best we can to, you know, pass all the kind of tests that exist when you go on to get certain certifications for selling, like, a commercial product. But, you know, again, we can set you up for success, but we can't actually guarantee it. But, I think if you did go try to send a game through and you failed, we'd love to know why it failed, just to see, like, you know, did you do some wacky, crazy wiring or get really creative with, you know, twisting wires together or something, just to see, like, what users actually do to make a game that didn't pass, I guess. But most importantly, like, you know, by making the hardware integration part really simple, we really wanted to let...
I have a question.
You spoke of certification. Can you just elaborate two parts? So one would, what would be a certification, like a Gottlieb? What would they have to go through if you wanted to do it? And secondly, what certifications do you have on your boards related to that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, all products... You know, there's something when you're doing something for yourself and not doing commercial releases. Like, UL doesn't really play much when you're doing something as a hobby. But if you're going to release a lot of games, you need to protect yourself in ways like that. Go get it UL listed. And, you know, if someone's house burns down because there was a bad practice on something you did in there, you're liable for that. And so, you know, what we're trying to do to help out in those areas is that we're trying all the parts that we buy, we're trying to buy, you know, UL power supplies and everything to help you along that path. So if you get certified, they don't try to question, like, hey, that power supply is not UL listed. You need to kind of do all this paperwork to prove that it passes those tests. As far as emissions, we're going to have all our boards tested when we go to manufacturing and what the EMI levels already are on there. I mean, pinball machines are terrible Faraday cages. They're made of wood, right? It's like the gremlins are going to get out. So there's a lot of things that they had done in the past. You'll notice a lot of metal in the back box areas and try to protect some of those areas in there. The ground strapping all the way around the machines for safety, right? We're going to try to educate people on that, but we, you know, again, we can't tell you what to do to make a safe machine. We'll give you guidelines on what had been done in the past. But, yeah, the things we can do is try to do everything UL that we put in there from the get-go. It's like we can sit there and test all our boards ahead of time to see how they do EMI-wise and all that. So when you do go get certified, if you do a big run, then your odds are you probably it's going to pass first time.
Is it just UL listing that you need, or can you list the other types of certification?
Well, UL and just the FCC are the big ones. Okay. So, you know, there's CE for other countries, and, you know, if you try to ship something like lead-free, right now we're currently not lead-free on all of our products, but we're moving that direction. So, yeah, the Roja stuff. So, really, you know, FCC and UL are the big ones.
Okay.
Yeah, and just to wrap up the new game creation topic, you know, one of the things that we really want to do is let designers be designers, you know, not force you into an engineering mode where you have to go through and actually learn extensive amounts about electronics to make sure you do it right. If we can fast-track the process of a designer actually designing, yeah, that frees the mind up and lets you focus on the tasks that are, you know, best suited for a game designer. And I think that, you know, that's an area too that, you know, we've discussed being willing to consult on projects and stuff like that, because keeping an engineering team on board with your company as you're just in a boutique group designing pinball machines, that's not usually something the budget can afford. But being able to kind of tap into, you know, our experience and stuff like that and working with the hardware is something we're really willing to do, and it's a great way to engage with designers and things like that and people making games. So it's kind of fun for us. Okay, so I think we cruised through a lot of the stuff I talked about with the enhanced games before. But one point that I kind of glazed over was, you know, when so this is back to like dropping in the existing hardware into a pre-existing game and kind of taking control. And one of the modes that was in there was, we call it like a tinker mode. And the idea for someone who wants to go in and learn how to like program for pinball, it's pretty cool to start with a game that already works. So you're not actually solving electronics problems and, you know, debugging and writing code, you know. So if you have a, like we had our booth out there, we have a funhouse there. And if you took, you know, one of these boards, put that in there, it basically gives you an interface to start, you know, writing code against it. So you can, you know, kind of get comfortable with stringing together different events, things like that, to make, you know, the buttons do what you want and the targets, you know, respond the way you want. And using a framework like the Mission Pinball framework, it fast tracks the process of getting, you know, a game wrapped around that. So it's that tinker mode is really kind of a cool layer that we've tried to work into these enhanced games, because it's, you know, if we're pushing out like a Funhouse 2.0, you know, in coordination with Planetary or something like that, it's kind of like a little, you know, an added bonus that you could, you know, you had a long rainy weekend, you want to learn how to program pinball, what a cool way to kind of switch modes and start tinkering with that.
We should go back even one step further. So on, you know, without any programming at all, if you literally hook up a console to the USB port on that fast pinball board, you stick it in the machine, as soon as you start pressing switches on the machine, it tells you what switch number is coming back. So you hit a flipper and all of a sudden it'll say, hey, switch number one just got pressed. And it says switch number one plus, which means it closed, and switch, you know, switch one minus when it reopens. When you want to turn on some GI, the instruction, there's a GI command. You can literally type GI and what GI channel you want and what intensity you want it to go to, and the GI turns on the pinball machine. So even without writing any code, you can start to have that experience. We also have a mode that searches all the coils. So if you don't know how they're all numbered, what is coil number one? You can put it in a test mode and start, you know, sending 20 millisecond pulses to each one of the coils to identify where they're at.
So it's just like scrolling through each one as they fire this coil, it's number one. Fire this coil, it's number two. Because again, like all the wiring as it gets all weaved around in there, it's not necessarily in any sort of logical order. And especially when you're dropping the board into an existing game like a WPC game, you don't know how that stuff gets reported in the system. So building in these little tools to make it easy to start like goofing around with it is really cool. I think that, you know, I mentioned, you know, we were trying the hardware out in one of the Skippy games, and it was fun because, you know, the hardware, everything was all wired up and ready to go, and all we had to do was come in and plug our stuff in, and then really quickly, the first thing we do is make a list of the coils, scroll through those, find all those, and then go through and touch every switch and see what's coming back as that's being reported. So then we start stringing it together. When this button's pressed, fire this coil for the flipper. So, you know, in just minutes, like, we can actually have the balls shooting up and testing shot lines and going up ramps and things like that. So it's very, like, natural in the design process. You know, you've got your white wood you've been laying out, and you plug the hardware in. But you're not ready necessarily for a full-on heavy code experience to actually program the game, because you're still trying to figure out if you put your ramps in the right place and stuff. So being able to get to where you can, like, flip flippers and stuff, like in the tinker mode that, like, you know, Dave was describing, just using the protocol commands itself, you know, you can be flipping flippers, you know, before your beer gets warm or your coffee gets cold. It's really exciting. So should we just go through, let's see, where are we at here?
Yeah, now we got a lot of pictures that I could hold the laptop up, but it's kind of like going through all the various aspects of the hardware. You know, so I don't know, the best visual we probably have on what, you know, a system looks like really is Aaron's here. And, you know, all the hardware to control this machine is actually underneath this play field here. So there's two driver boards in this machine. One of them is right here, and the other one is right down there. And what's nice about these driver boards is since they both have switch inputs and drivers for all the various coils in the machine, you can locate them, you know, right near the areas that you're trying to control. So we already mentioned that the board that was passed around has 32 inputs and 8 outputs. Well, two of those boards gives you 64 inputs, which is, you know, that's the standard on most of the machines, and 16 drivers. Now, you'll notice that most machines have more than 16 drivers, but they usually have less than 16 coils. All the rest of those drivers were for running, you know, flashers, and were kind of overkill, really, to have those big old, you know, chip transistors driving all those flashers, but that's the way it was done. But now with the LEDs that we have, it's like you can simulate a flasher, you can simulate, you know, an insert. So it's like with the 256 LEDs, which is more channels than the pinball machines ever had, what the lamp matrices were, 64 lamps, right? So now we gave you four times that in LEDs, so you can kind of really dress up the play field. So yeah, I mean, just with those two boards, it's pretty much that's all you need underneath the play field. Aaron did happen to mount his controller board in the back here, which you normally could put somewhere else. That could be in your back box if you choose to do that. One advantage of putting in the back box is the DMD connector is there, and also HDMI coming off the BeagleBone Black, so you're closer to your display if you want to do that. But again, you know, you're welcome to put it underneath. What's really cool to me is that I always, you know, like to take the play fields out, and it's a pain to do in all machines with that half mile of wire sitting in there, right? But now with all the hardware underneath, literally we have power cables, Ethernet cables, and if you decide to put in the interlock switch on your door to stop our fuse block, then you need the interlock switch kind of coming up to the board as well. But that's all you need. So with a couple connections disconnect, you can go take your play field somewhere else and go work on it. And to me, that's a huge advantage over the old games. Yes?
Quick question. You mentioned DMV. And if you're doing something custom, what would you do with the DMV? How would you handle that? Can you make custom displays?
So we have a full DMD driver on the controller board. So we have a controller dedicated just to driving the DMD. So, you know, we can get a little bit more about how the architecture works. So right now we have, the way the system appears to the outside world is there's three pipes. And it took a lot of iterations and talking to people like with Mission Framework on what would be the best way to control the machine. Originally we had one pipe that went out and controlled the DMD, the RGB LEDs, and the game control. From a software standpoint, when you're trying to, you know, design software, you might want to put a whole bunch of DMD images, and you don't want the rest of the controllers in there listening to all this garbage meant for the DMD, right? So what we did is we separated that out to three pipes. So we have a pipe to control DMD directly. We have one to control RGB LEDs. Hey, fan of white over there. Yeah. Nice.
Some visual aids.
And then we have another controller for all of the game I.O. And these are presented as high-speed serial ports. So if you're plugged into a BeagleBone Black, then there's three serial ports on that BeagleBone Black controlling each one of these. If you're hooked into the PC, it appears as three CDC ports over USB. So it's like, as a software developer, you know exactly what you have to do to go, you know, have access to that DMD display. So in your case, there's a series of commands, DMD commands, that lets you put out a raw image or, you know, feed, like, go change specific pixels or whatever you want to do. There's raw commands to do that, or it's like through like the Mission Framework, you know, it's like they have tools as well to help with all that.
So if you're using like BeagleBone, you would, or is there some documentation you might have on how you might generate an image for DMD and then pipe it through your thing to the DMD?
Yeah, we're going to start releasing more of the documentation, but yeah, there's the commands are very simple on how to dump data out, so we will kind of show the format of that and what you have to do to make it go. But
right.
It's
yeah, actually, Brian, you want to chime in on that one?
I was going to say, were you the last session that Gabe and I did?
Yeah.
So if you just joined, so Gabe and I wrote this thing called a Mission Pinball Framework, which is a Python-based software for creating pinball machines. So our framework talks to the fast hardware. We've got rock hardware in that machine. You know, ours is a hardware-independent framework. Think about it. So the fast, they're building hardware. They've got a DMD interface. They've got, you know, the BeagleBone's going to have the HDMI interface if you want to use an LCD instead of a DMD, or you can simulate a DMD on an LCD. So they've got all the hardware interfaces for that. But you need game code. And you can write that yourself from scratch. You can use the Mission Pinball Framework as your starting point. You can hack our framework, you know, whatever you want to do. We haven't written the DMD support. Our LCD support is done. We haven't written the DMD stuff yet, which we just haven't gotten time. That'll be in the next few months. That's what kind of done in software. So there's a bunch of different ways you can do it. Like you can have kind of grayscale, like PNG files that it then processes, you know, like dot by dot, and then turns the orange dots on or off for the DMD. There's a bunch of kind of ways it happens. But
so the ODroid that you would use for your controller could also sort of be generating your DMD.
Exactly, and the way it works, so the actual like physical DMDs have that 14-pin data connection that are used on those plastic machines. So there's no DMD interface on an ODroid, you know. So in that case, the ODroid is sending the DMD commands via USB to their board, and their board is hammering all the timings on the pins to make that actually show up. So if you want to use an LCD, or even if you want to use an LCD with like a dot to like simulate a DMD, it's actually going to come out of the computer. Like you use the ODroid with this HDMI port to the LCD to simulate the DMD. If you want to use a physical DMD, it's going to go to their board. And from the software standpoint, it's all the same. In fact, we'll use a software DMD if you're working on your laptop, it might play on screen, and then the exact same code, same animation, same files, when you run it with the physical hardware, could send those out to the actual DMD itself.
Because the physical hardware is really like the gateway to what you're plugging into, so it lets you take advantage of all the existing DMD pieces and parts that are out there. But you know, again, making the protocol in a way that accepts all those commands lets like the Mission Pinball framework take animations and live scoring and merge that together in a way and delivers those frames out to the DMD. So it really provides that interface.
I just want to follow up with the color DMD guys. Would that plug into that board and work seamlessly also? Or?
Well, I think all their stuff's going to be synced up with like actually the existing animations that are going out, and they recognize like each dot and present a frame or a colored version of that frame base that's going out. So if you were running, I guess if you're running like a VPIN main like through this, the DMD data going out, I've never tested that myself.
Well, here's how it works. Color DMD, if you haven't seen that thing, it's just an LCD screen. It's like a laptop screen. But they have a little interface, and it plugs through the 14-pin connector. Now, inside their little hardware, they actually manually screen scrape all the dots from the original. So you plug it to Attack from Mars. Some poor person, we feel sorry for, spent weeks in the basement, like screen by screen, pixel by pixel, scraping out dots and looking for all the animations inside Attack from Mars and then generating new color ones from scratch.
Yeah.
So in this case, you use a fast board. Like if you want to use an Attack from Mars and like write your own software from that, you plug this board in instead of the main MPU. But you wouldn't need to go through all that hassle of like sending actual DMD and then being rescraping.
Right.
You just take that LCD and plug it right into your Odroid or your BeagleBone or whatever, and then just send the commands right to it.
And there you have the benefit that the work's already done for you by the color DMD guys.
Right.
But if you wanted to, you could use an LCD, plug that right into the host computer, and do your own color conversion.
So if you're doing your own, the path might be better to just go LCD and skip.
End results the same.
If you want color.
Yes.
In our case, we like the look of the classic DMDs, so like stuff we work on, we'll use the actual DMD because we want the physical, like the actual individual, you know, LEDs and the thing.
I think it's down to where you want to put the effort, whether it's like trying to synchronize with something that already exists. You know, you spend the time getting it all dialed and just write to work with the existing one, or take the time to write it from scratch and use it yourself so you get full control of it.
It depends if you want weeks in the basement, right? That's what it comes down to.
Real quick, I'll say, if you're writing your own Attack from Mars, you're going to have your own animations and all that kind of stuff. Well, the color of the DMD doesn't know what that thing is, so it's just going to play it through, like, not in color.
Yeah.
So
color DMD is kind of useless unless you're retrofitting into an existing.
It's
designed to just bridge the gap from
that. That's only the game they've done.
Correct.
So you're building your own game.
That's a plug-in.
Yeah.
You got one and you want the color, you want to plug it, plug their little board in, and now you've got color because they spent all that time making those colors.
So same question for sound then. Do you expect the sound just to come off the host PC, or do you have any additional hardware?
Let me address that one. So if you're controlling with a PC, then the sound would come from the PC. But if you're using a BeagleBone Black, the BeagleBone Black does not have an audio, doesn't have audio support native to it. But you can add a codec to it to have audio. So what we've done is we've added the audio codec on the board. So it's like, and you know, so that would be the experience, is that you could put a player on there.
Yeah.
I don't know what you use to sit there and play it on the BeagleBone Black, but I know you've already
tested working through the framework. Like you can be sending out the sound commands and stuff, and it'll interface with our protocol to send those commands out. And again, like the hardware is abstracted, so it's like if the best choice for it is to send it out through, you know, this audio out on this form factor.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is one where the BeagleBone Black itself, as it seats on here, doesn't have that audio out on it. So we added those features to this. So you have that nice compact piece. And again, like the BeagleBone Black is the only thing that you can connect to this too. I mean, there's separate dedicated pins here that talk to each of the individual processors. So if you want to create your own interface using some other processor, I mean, that's going to be a documented set of connections and stuff that you can interface to.
Like I can run on my laptop and just plug in with the USB port. Because when you can snap on the BeagleBone Black, it's just a form factor convenience thing to snap it on.
Exactly.
You don't have to use a BeagleBone Black if you don't want to.
Just like in the Medieval Madness out there, like the remake, they're using the same BeagleBone Black computer. It's just that it's powerful enough. It's got like interfaces for, you know, wireless and things like that you might want to use. But it's just a nice compact piece that fits in. So.
And the thing that plays the music and the sound is the code. So
correct.
You know, we're using Python, so it's literally you import the sound module into the game, and then you just say play this song file.
Right.
And the end.
Yeah,
if you're retrofitting an existing game, you can also access the original sounds that are in the sound ROMs. Those are more accessed by ID, so you can send, you know,
right,
play sound 14, and if you have the original soundboard in there, it'll go and find it and play that. And you can even mix and match those with you know, your own sounds you create and the original sounds.
Yeah, so like this is a connector for the soundboard in a WPC game. So you plug that in, and within the hardware, we take your commands, structure in a way it needs to be to call out those sounds and play them out. So, you know, it's one of the little tinker mode things we had is like, you'll be able to take, you scroll through the commands and get through the audio sounds that are there so you can identify that, and then tie that to a button so you're going to make this target just play a sound. It's kind of a novel way to get familiar with the ins and outs of the hardware itself. So.
But again, you wouldn't be able to change that easily. So it's, right. You know, it's like you're stuck with the sounds that are there unless you want to go back and do it the way the forefathers did, right. To put those sound, you know, in the sound ROM. So I don't think that'd be very exciting. Again, I think that's weeks in the basement. So.
And you know, we're having that chime.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
You don't need it. I mean, you do all sound.
And on that topic too, we're talking about the DMD content. We're talking about the sounds and things. You know, with when I talk about the things with, you know, working with Planetary and Rick and these guys to get these enhanced games out, the big hanging point on that stuff is the original assets. Who owns these sounds? Who owns these animations? All those things. And it's just an old school like IP restriction. We don't want that out in the wild. So, you know, one of the things we had to do was be able to create an interface to the existing things in a way that like protects it. And so again, like, you know, that's where the effort to set up the infrastructure in place so you can take a little bit of both. So imagine, like, you know, in this enhanced mode, you're working with an existing game where you're using all the existing sounds and animations, but you drop in a few of your own, you know, to kind of swap out different pieces and stuff. So that's really what people want with like that enhanced experience with working with existing games is to personalize it. And, you know, we've worked really hard to, you know, provide the hardware interface to do it, provide the protection that's going to be needed to protect those assets. But really, it's about now kind of pushing a little forward to say, can we get the support to write new game code that we can include in this mechanism as well? So you're not having to go either blank slate or protected ROMs. It's this middle ground that's developing. So that's kind of the ongoing topic right now.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
That's good. This guy's had a question here, real quick.
You said it would drop DMD and HDMI?
Yeah, so, in the HDMI, it's going to come out.
You could, because one of them's coming through a pipe, one of the pipes I mentioned, right? And the other one's coming directly from the BeagleBone Black, the HDMI. So you could run them simultaneously. No one's ever asked that. Good question. That's great. There's a question in the back.
Yeah, if I wanted to replace sounds in my current machine, would I just need your WPC controller?
Well, that's kind of where it's a combination of a lot of different things coming together. So, like, if you wanted to drop this in your WPC game and have different events, like you play sounds, you're going to be using, like, the mission framework, for example, and start writing that in. But again, it's a blank slate at that point. And so what we're trying to do, and working with Rick and everybody, is come up with a way to say, just like ColorDMB does, when they go through and say, we've colorized this game, we'd like to be able to work with them and say, we've modernized this code set. And it's an IP restriction touching point that, you know, we're willing to put in the time to like kind of work that stuff out. But that's an area where Rick and those guys have been really cool, because it's just short of annoying, you know, to be like, I got to go back and retinker with all this old stuff, like, and open up all these issues. But again, like, when we pushed the hardware out and said, this is a way to deliver it, they were actually to go back to the IP holders and say, hey, we want to expand this and start doing more. We want to start bringing more code and different form factors and stuff. So again, it's chipping away at like kind of these old structures and old restrictions and things, and providing like a way to kind of meet the needs of both sides. So, but I mean, that's really what people want to do, is tinker with it, you know, tweak things.
So what's your recommendation? So I'm building custom games from scratch now. If I use that board, do I want to go out and get like a Williams solenoid driver board, or do I want to use your daughter board? Or do I have to use a combination of those?
Well, you can choose. I mean, we call it, yeah, too, yeah. And there's another image coming up too, where he got this smaller board. But again, it's probably better just to pass it around than to show the images on his laptop.
So this piece here was designed for new games. So it's all the same technologies that exist, but shutting away all the old interfaces that aren't needed.
So there's no switch matrix on here. There's no let's go talk to the DMD interface to say, well, the sound interface is all gone on here. We never talked to the DMD off this connector like the original machine did, because it required that whole crazy RAM board and with weird timing. So we always put the DMD controller right on that board, so you connect directly into here rather than going to the DMD board in the Williams machine. So we have the DMD interface on here as well. So I can walk around all the connectors here first. So this is the power in connector on here. It's the same power connector like on WPC. It's 12 volts, 5 volts, and ground on there. And then we have the DMD interface, the 14-pin header that Brian was mentioned is sitting right here. So that's where the DMD would go. Over here is a traditional driver board connector that could go over to a WPC, System 11, or almost whatever else. It's really, a parallel data bus with a whole bunch of strobes on it. So if you had segmented displays that you wanted to run, you could run them right off here. If you have an old Williams board you want to run, you could run that right off here.
You kind of call it the legacy connection. Like if you're using this modern one, but you want to tap back into some old connections and interfaces, like we want to make sure that that existed.
Because some people like the lamp matrix, some people like the GI, you know, all that soft lighting, you know, tubes, right? You know, it's good stuff. So down here is the network interface that goes onto our board. So this one really doesn't have any drivers or any switches in it. It's just a small board that, you know, the BeagleBone Black fits on or from the USB. So I don't have one of our other driver boards here, but every single one of them. So every one of our boards features two RJ45 jacks on it. So it starts from here on the controller board and then goes to your first network board, and it just keeps daisy chaining all the way back. The last board comes back onto the controller board again. Now what's cool about that is that because of this entire loop, all the boards are identified in the system in the order that they're put in. So this one right here, let's see, this is a 3208 board. So we have eight drivers here. This is driver 0 and this is driver 7. If you have another board right next to it and has a driver on it, it automatically becomes driver number 8, just by the order that they're in your system. We have switch number 0 here. We end with switch number 31. Switch number 32 on the next switch in the system, wherever it's at, that's the way it works. So every single board too features a couple LEDs on here. Again, I had a really cool slide on that. But the LEDs on here are like status, which lets you know this thing is alive and well, kind of flashing, kind of the old diagnostic connector on the WPC board style. Then we have a link LED on every one that shows you that they're properly in the chain and they've been enumerated and figured out their position in there. So if that light's on all your boards, life is good. If one of them's out, then you need to check the connections between those boards. The other one I really like a lot, it's called Active, and what it does is anytime something on this particular board changes, not in the system, but on this particular board, it'll flash for a moment. So that means if you're testing your switches, like, is my wiring okay? You could pull the switch harness off and go all the way down on each one of the switches and see that LED is strobing for every single time there's been a change in this board. And then it tells you whether it's the board or it's the, you know, your wiring somewhere. So it's really kind of easy to diagnose without even having a system what's going on, because again, these boards are going to be very close to where the hardware is in the machine. So anyway, that's the way that kind of works, and that's what this connector is on here, is the ins and outs going to that to all the network cards. Yeah, question.
Okay, so basically, a BeagleBone, that board, the driver board, and do the code you run.
Yep, absolutely.
And this way.
And in this form factor too, you basically have all you need to get your lower third going. You know, it's like,
here, I'll pass
you start adding more features, right, but right. You know, that low level starting point, it's great. I mean, you're in and working.
And your RGB lights that you just showed, mm-hmm. the panel, does that need a special controller, or does that run right off of the...
Running right off. So
serial.
And believe it or not, it's funny, guys, that LED controller has been very exciting to work on. It's like you can find all over the web controllers to control those RGB LEDs. But the thing is that the data protocol on that is very bizarre, and it's like 800 kHz. It's like it takes any processor to its knees. Now, if you put a really high-speed processor in there, sure, it can do it, but you're babysitting that thing so much. We wanted all of our hardware to be 100% non-blocking. We literally had to put two processors in to control those LEDs, more sophisticated than anything else. One controller is controlling the LED change and updating them about 100 frames a second. The other one is the one listening to you, like what changes do you want to that chain? So it's like, you know, as far as a software development, you never are in sync. You don't have to, oh my God, is it busy? Let me wait until it's done. It's like you just sit there and talk to the controller that you're supposed to talk to, and that talks to the other one that's updating those frames.
That's on this new board.
That's on the new board.
So if you're retrofitting a machine, you'll go with that one. If you're starting from scratch, you go with this one.
Correct.
Yeah.
And what's cool with having them on here, I mean, we added it on here because we had space. With the smaller parts using this exact, this is the same form factor as the WPC board. So by adding that in, you know, if you go through and write some new game code for your game, and you want to add RGB LEDs to it and brighten things up and stuff like that, it's a really cool way to start enhancing an existing game. Because adding some strips of lighting and stuff like that to your existing game is not really that destructive. You know, you can, you know, put some strips down a ramp if you want. When a certain switch gets hit, a time stream of light goes down. It's time, you know, you've timed it to work with the ball speed rolling down. You know, so it's a cool little way to start working mods and stuff in there too. And that was why we actually ended up putting the network controller on the WPC board itself. Is we've had people ask, like, could I add a few more drivers to it because I want to have it
do something else. You know, like, you know, again, different people's projects, you know, where they're at, whether they're just trying to, you know, bring new life to the form factor. Maybe it's a busted down Funhouse and they want to start with Funhouse and add more to it. What people are willing to do to their games varies a lot. But really, we want to make sure that we had the interfaces that didn't limit the creativity on it.
Because I think some games ran out of I.O. I think, like Theater of Magic, I think there was a couple more toys they wanted in there. I think the Saw, and I think there was a levitating wand that was supposed to be in there originally, and he was out of I.O. drivers on there, or out of time, or I can't remember what all the stories were. But so now if you're doing a 2.0 remake of that game and want to bring that stuff back, well, now all you have to do is add a small controller outside on the network interface, and you can kind of control those other aspects of the machine.
Even back on my Fire and F-14, they had was it A and C relays, because they had the power driver, but they didn't have enough for all the coils they wanted to fire, so they took a lamp to fire the relay, and without the lamp, it's this one, and with the lamp, it's that one, yeah. And you go into diagnostics, they don't all fire.
Yeah,
you have to be really creative with them and your colors at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And on your driver boards, let's say you start out with just the one. Later you go down and want to add more, so you just turn it off, plug it in, wire it in, turn it on, and it, when it boots up, it figures out there's another board and assigns it.
We've been plugging them in hot. Yeah. So, yeah, you can't power it down, but yeah, no.
Okay, those games have something to do that.
Yeah. But yes, absolutely.
Okay, and the next question is, let's say for some reason you smack one of your boards and you physically broke it. Shut it off, pull that one out, stick another one in, turn the game back on. It doesn't care?
Does not care. That's like zero configuration on the board. It does it all on the fly.
Pretty fun.
And what else is
really... As long as you keep your daisy chain in the same order.
In the same order, yeah. Otherwise, yeah, I get some really weird results.
My first bank of stuff should be right here. Here it is. Maybe the next one.
Color code your sockets and plugs. This is one. Yeah. This is two.
Yeah.
But what's really cool is it really follows the kind of natural process of creating things.
Yes.
You know, like, I mean, I love to get in and, like, start up a play field, and I've got the lower part flipping right away. And so I start moving my ramps around and things like that. And as you get further and further in your game, you know, you switch over to high-level code, and you're writing your game framework, and you get just this one part seems dead, and you want to add some other targets to it. And again, being able to scale, you know, really nice is fun, and it fits the natural process.
Yeah. So. And something I'm seeing is the overwhelming side of it all. Let's say you do take an old game and want to redo it.
Right.
You stick this in, you get the lower going, now you've actually got, you're at a plateau.
Right.
I can play a little bit.
Yeah.
It decides where I'm going, and when I want to do it, I can plug that in and go. And if I don't want to and I just want to play it, I can unplug it.
Yeah. It's just so satisfying to be able to, like, plug things in, you've got everything wired up, and I'm shooting stuff around, you know?
Exactly.
And as a builder creator type, it's like I love to see stuff come to life, you know. And it's, you know, the first time we got like our hardware controlled, you know, software controlling our hardware was like, you know, tier 90 moment. It's like, gosh, it comes to life, you know.
And a shocking moment too. Yeah. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
There's a little story on that. Oh, so
you had to tell that one. That was
so the very first time I actually had a Twilight Zone that we plugged our first, you know, WPC full length 2.0 board in and got, you know, firing up for the first time, so we're all excited. We're standing around the machine, and
it's late at night, so we're gonna be real quiet too.
Yeah, wife's upstairs sleeping. So anyway, we go to turn the board on, and everything looks like it's going good. We're watching the blanking LED because we have the same blanking LED that cuts all the hardware off for a few seconds to make sure the system's stable before it comes on. And so we're watching that LED, and then it goes out, and it's like fuses blue. They look like strobe lights going off, and just huge noise.
Like, oh my God.
And what happened is I didn't realize.
First we're leaning in the box, wondering what's going on, and boom, right in their face.
I didn't realize that Williams had inverted all of their drivers. So zero is on and one is off. So I had initialized all the drivers to zero. So instead of turning everything off when the blanking signal.
Someone like freaked out. He's like, hold on, I think this switches the one thing. It was good.
Yeah, it was just like a couple more seconds. Hey, all right. And I didn't wake her up either, which is the best part. I don't know how she slept through that. Knocker, everything. I mean, all at once.
Jumping in. Oh, my God.
We were so,
what's that?
We were the same way.
Did you? Yeah. Oh, man.
So, I mean, bottom line, even just, like, making games, stuff like that, but we've been having a lot of fun, like, building the stuff along the way. I mean, like, we're really excited about seeing what people can make with it and what can be done. And I think even, like, you know, we were showing the new game controller PCB, like, you know, we wanted to have those in time for the show, but instead they were, it was cutting it close. We actually had them mail them to us at the hotel here so we could see it.
They arrived yesterday, brought it up to our room even. That was kind of nice.
So it's just been a lot of fun. Like, you know, I get excited when I, you know, we have discussions and stuff like this, and you start to see the wheels turning going, okay, if I had that, I could make this, you know, and that's really what has been a lot of fun. And I think think a lot of really excited people, pinball creators and designers and stuff like that are seeing the potential for it. And we want to be a resource for that. We want to be engaged. We've taken a lot of time to get to know people doing different things in pinball and get that feedback and stuff. And you know, we have a lot of people to thank for that whole process, but we've been really fortunate to have a lot of really excited people go, you know, I'm not going to build hardware myself, but I know this one problem that I think you should know about. And you know, at the different shows we've gone to, I've been surprised that people will seek us out going, I've read about what you're doing with your hardware. Please address this thing. You know, and that's just been, you know, we've been trying to be really engaged and stuff. And, you know, we come out to these shows and hearing feedback and stuff like that, even as the hardware's iterating, we're getting closer and closer. We've made a lot of friends who come out and say, like, how's it going? You know, last time you were talking about this, how'd that go? And so it's been fun. It's definitely been a lot of fun.
I have one more point I wanted to address on your question about the hardware and, you know, when we're plugging and unplugging them. One thing really cool that may not come across is that these boards, once you sit there and tell them, like, this switch drives this coil, right? We have a switch, it's a flipper. There's a trigger coil and there's a hold coil, right? So all those rules can be put onto this board so that when a switch input comes on, it automatically fires this. The software does not have to do that. So all the stuff can be figured to do it automatically. But
it'll actually like trigger the event and then tell the host PC this happened, as opposed to going up there and saying, now you need to fire this. So
what's really nice about that is you know, it's like there's a lot of less CPU power required at the high end to manage all that, right? You're really kind of more interested, hey, a switch happened, I want to do the sound, I want to update the score in this way. So, but if you unplug these boards, all that configuration data was on this board. So if you happen to unplug and plug back in hot or something happened during the play, well, all that parameter stuff's gone. But what's really nice is the system will actually keep refreshing in the background all the time. So as all the network data is going across, if they don't match, it's like the data will be copied back onto the board. And that's my favorite thing doing, like unplugging and plugging in, is you plug it in hot and all of a sudden the personality, how this is running, comes right back. Pop bumpers start going, slingshots start going. So you can, anyway, it's been a lot of fun playing with those automatic aspects of the boards.
Yes? How long have you been doing this process?
Whew, boy. Well, how long this is, two questions. Like, this actually came from, I do a lot of, like, military networking sensors and all that, so a lot of this been probably 15 years is the right question.
Don't ask any questions about it.
Yeah, don't ask any questions about that. But as far as doing it with the pinball stuff, it was probably about a year now, I would think.
Yeah, a year and a half. We kind of got things rolling with the ideas and things and iterated over different versions. We really kind of locked in on this system design and stuff like that about a year ago, I think. And we've been refining that over and over again as we've...
So, this is like a smart sensor technology is where this really comes from. And so the military, if you're like securing fences, what have you, where you have a whole bunch of networks that all have to talk to one another to secure a perimeter, that's kind of like the same type of technology that's being used in here. It's using RJ45 jacks, but it's a completely different. Yeah. So it's a little
different. So
they're
actually powering the boards themselves over those connections as well. So that's actually what brings the onboard processor up. Is actually just the 12 volts coming over the network.
Yeah. So we have 12 volts. Yeah, and a couple communication channels on there. So it's a differential pair, but we have a couple of channels on there for identification and doing some other cute little things like that on how they figure their whole place in the system.
Do you use shielded cable?
You don't have to because of the differential aspects. I mean, if you do running, you know...
Oh, so it's like XLR where it's listening for noise over one channel and then it sees it and then it knows something weird.
Yeah, we also do a 16 times over sample in all the data, so you'd have to have noise there for quite some time. Now, okay. You know, practice, do you want to run big, long parallel paths next to all your coil watts? Probably not. If you do, you might want to use shielded wire if you start to have interference problems. But we've done what we could to try to make sure it doesn't affect anything. But mileage may vary, so if you have problems, move the cables over or go shielded. So we are not using shielded cables for any of our stuff, and we have not seen any problems yet.
Does it require additional power in addition to that for the power boards?
No, no power is on our boards. We only switch grounds, kind of the way, you know, all the machines worked. And we went one step further. Our fuse block isolates all the power, so there is no, even through the coils, there's no high voltage on if you do it right. We don't want people playing around with the high voltages on that same board. So our board only requires the 12 volts coming through the Ethernet jacks or the RJ45 jacks. And then all other power that we need is derived from that. And it's very little. We need enough to keep the switches happy. You know, we are running the switches at a pulled up level, so it will work with, Hall effect sensors and work with optos and all of that. So there is some power derived off of 12 volts for that, but otherwise all of our stuff's running at 3.3 and 12 volts, and we have DC switchers on the board already to take care of that. So 12 volts runs all our stuff. You know, you will have your, you know, lights, the LEDs are at 5, so you will have to provide a 5 volts if you're using the LEDs, and then whatever high voltage you're using for your, you know, coils.
I was going to show too, like this crazy box here that I made, this is it's basically my dev kit. So I've got different play fields and stuff like that I keep on my desk. And what this is basically something I can plug in, and I've got a 48 volt supply here that I'm using for my high voltage, and then this flap delivers the 5 and 12 volts. So both of those connect into our board, and that's where it continues down to get the 5 volts for the LEDs and 3.3 to control the processors. To use this kind of off the shelf switching one, we'd add a couple big caps to help smooth out the power, so you're doing, you know, the flipper flips and things like that, you don't end up like dropping voltage. But again, this was just, I mean, this is basically like everything that you need aside from some network boards, and those are obviously sitting underneath the play field in the designs I've worked on. But again, like that just becomes two network connections here, and the whole system's set powered up. And then the one line that goes out to, this is the fuse block here we've talked about. There'd be one line here that would go to the play field providing the high voltage power on it. So it's really kind of a fun little like compact thing. I've showed it to friends, they're like, oh my God, I want to make one of those, you know? So the suggestion has been, can we put two flipper buttons on the side so I can just. So again, I think that, you know, just kind of showing that this is that big complex pinball machine that we all know in a box, and it's really fun when you can kind of take down the daunting factor of where do I start and show it. And this is a box, you know. If you can hook up a stereo, I mean, you've got higher voltage and stuff like that, obviously. But if you can follow some instructions and hook up things the way you're told, there it is, you know. So it's really exciting. It's really fun to kind of demystify the whole process a bit too. So yeah. I don't want to go on time.
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
Okay. Cool. Thanks so much.
All right.